Hi, everybody. This is Janice, and I'm back with the Cambridge University Law Society podcast. I forgot to mention in the last episode that this is a new little series I'm doing called Beyond Doctrine, where I speak to academics about the works they've been publishing or any really interesting things they've been getting up to recently. In today's episode, I speak to Poorna Mysore, who used to supervise me in tort law, about her new monograph, Copyright as Personal Property. If you've been lucky enough to have been supervised by Poorna, you'll know that she has this remarkable ability to break down really complex topics into quite simple ideas, and I think she definitely did that in this discussion. One of the interesting things she does is use visual diagrams. We speak about the graph at the end of her book towards the end of the discussion, but if you're interested in seeing what that graph is or what we're talking about, check out the Instagram because I've linked a picture there. All right, well, that's it for me. No spoiler alerts, no disclaimers, although I will say there's a point in the discussion where I get very excited about the taste of cheese potentially being a copyright issue, but that's really more of a personal endeavor and just something I think about a lot. All right, well, hopefully you guys enjoy this episode and I will see you guys very, very soon. Today I'm joined by Poorna Mysore, and we're at her office in Lucy Cavendish, the same office where I once plowed through many a tort supervision, but today we're not going to be talking about that. Tort talk is old news. Thank you so much for being here with me today, and we're going to talk about your new monograph, Copyright as Personal Property. To start off the discussion a little bit more lightly, do you want to talk a little bit about the cover of the book and how that came to life?
Thank you so much, Janice. This is a really wonderful opportunity for me to talk about something I've been laboring over for the last 6 years, and now it's finally come to kind of fruition in a way. The cover, it is my mother's art, and my mother is a trained artist, although not practicing artist. So this was one of those that I put forward as an incentive for her to get back to her practice of the art. You will see under the art a little signature, which is her name and the date on which she completed this art. So it is, I mean, the cover explores the idea of a triangle. Triangle is important to me conceptually because a triangle represents three points of view. It's not linear, not just two points. There is always a third point of view. So if it is linear and only two points of view which are divergent, then you could have a polarized point of view. You could have binary points of view. Very few things in life are binary. You always have a third point of view. You always have a case, the opportunity to raise a third point of view, a third way of thinking. So that's why a triangle is important, in my view. When you build triangle over triangle, the possibilities of different points of view would be just, it just goes through the roof. Mm-hmm. The possibilities of fresher ideas, the possibilities of newer ways of thinking is just explosive and exponential, the number of ways of thinking. That's what this cover, if you see from one or two triangles, it just explodes into many, many triangles. And the tapestry of these different colors and different shapes of the triangle, that's what represents different points of view of the same idea, basic idea, which is the triangle. So that's what we are trying to explore here.
It's brilliant. Your new book argues that the inner workings of copyright law have developed with deference to property theory, and that many doctrinal issues can be addressed by maintaining a close analogy with land law and personal property law. Do you want to begin by explaining where we have currently placed copyrights within property theory, and what do you argue should be different about its current position?
Yeah, sure. So copyright is a statutory right, as you would know. In the statute, not just the statute that we have today, but the statute even about 100 years ago or more, the statute had been insisting that copyright is a property right. But somewhere along the way, we completely lost sight of how this is the case. What makes it a property right? What gives it the attributes of property? It was kind of lost over a period of time. And it came to a pass where there was even a division in the understanding of what copyright is because it's intangible. The group of intangibles, the classification of intangibles, it has just so much diversity that putting copyright together with debt and shares, just the whole thing didn't make any sense. If you put all of chattels together in one box, at least the unifying factor is that you can touch and feel it, you can take possession of it. There are certain laws that will work similarly for them. Even the exclusionary rights will probably work similarly for those chattels. But if you look at debt and if you look at copyright, there is nothing that unites them except the fact that they're both intangible. So is the intangibility enough for us to put it all in one box and forget about what the taxonomy really says? Yeah. Should we not have a bit more of a nuanced way of classifying also the intangibles? Yeah. And if we do want to pay attention to how further we can classify the intangibles, are we not going to come across aspects of copyright that will possibly be much closer to tangible things than intangible property that we know, such as shares or debt? So this kind of question made me realize that maybe copyright and perhaps all of intellectual property are a group of their own. Although they're intangible, they're conceptualized always having much more of chattels and land in mind, much less of shares or debt in mind. So for us to group the whole thing as intangibles and what English common law calls as shows us in action is something that just conflates so much and loses so much clarity. And this is something I wanted to protest about. You know, you don't have just two things, tangible and intangible, yeah. And we can all go home.
Yeah.
That's not how I wanted the classification of property theory, the subject matter of property. But also, I wanted us to think about the categorization not as silos, but as something that informs each other. If you have the same label of property for everything, what unifies it and what divides it? Do we really have a clear enough idea? That's what I wanted us to think about. And that's how I thought copyright as personal property would be a good thing to write about. The important thing I've done in this book is I have taken copyright only as a matter of illustration. It is an example that shows how it shows how intangible assets in general can be conceptualized if they were to be something like copyright, something which has exclusionary rights which are statutorily given. So what happens if you have something like copyright, and how can you think about intangibles in a much more nuanced way? That's what I have tried to do here. So what should be different about the current position? The difference that I would like to see in the current position is, yes, it's justified for us to have the label of property for copyright, but also a deeper appreciation of what this property-ness means for copyright. There needs to be a deeper understanding of that.
Yeah.
So labels are fine, but have a kind of deeper understanding is what I'm insisting that we should have with copyright.
And how do you think this kind of deeper understanding that you're arguing for, of not kind of bifurcating things and saying tangibles and intangibles, how does that develop our understanding of property law in general?
So property theory, let's begin with that and then come to property law specifically. Property theory so far, like I said, you have the classification, the bifurcation or binary classification of shows us in possession, shows us in action. So shows us in possession, you can in general call them all tangibles because those are the ones which you can take possession of, keep, hold, enjoy, all of that. So it could be chattels and land. And you have shows us in action, which can be any right for the enforcement of which you'll have to go to the court. That is the broad and general idea of what shows in action is. And that can be a debt, it can be shares, and it can technically be intellectual property right as well. But shows in action as a label itself is hugely contentious. You know, almost 200 years ago, sort of late 1800s, about 150 years ago, the debate had already started that shows in action is not a very happy classification for all intangibles being put together. So in my book, I reference a whole series of articles that were published in LQR just after Colonial Bank and Winnie was decided. So that was the case where the court spoke about there being no tertium quid, as in there's no third category, there's only shows in action and shows in possession. So that was a kind of case which almost said that it was a thing that's written in stone, that you can only have tangibles and intangibles and nothing in between. A lot of people at the time already wondered, what about intellectual property? Because intellectual property is not like debt, because debt is only enforceable between two people, the person who is indebted and the person to whom the debt is owed. So it's a contractual right. Privity governs that only two people are part of that transaction and it's enforceable between the two of them. But if you look at copyright or any other intellectual property for that matter, it has rights in rem that are granted in relation to the subject matters. The whole world could be coming under a duty of some kind of exclusion in relation to that subject matter. So to what extent can you say that copyright is also a chosen action, just like a debt? There is so much difference. To start off with, it's not just two people entering into a transaction. Yeah. Copyright is just completely different. Yeah. Nothing could be more different than that. So this sort of debate had already begun 150 years ago. And then over a period of time, because copyright became such a specialized area, and really intellectual property again gained its own specialization kind of a label. Because of that, it became the forte of certain people who were interested in the area. And general property theorists kind of forgot about intellectual property. They left it for intellectual property specialists to deal with these subjects. We will continue to deal with land and chattel, so we'll be happy. So many of the property theorists continued to focus very much on the tangibles. And intellectual property theorists went ahead thinking that, okay, we don't have to really settle that debate whether what kind of a property right is copyright. We know that it is a property right of a kind, whatever it might be. We'll just leave that for now. We will focus on other issues that are much more relevant to IP. Nothing wrong with that. Yes, there are lots of other issues for the specialists to focus on. But what has happened over time is the bridge between the two is completely broken. There is no common ground that you can find between tangibles and intangibles. So it's the divide, in a way, kind of grew as a rift. So that is something I wanted to prevent from happening. And doctrinally, why would I want to do that? Why does this affect property law in general? Is because a lot of law, property law, in relation to tangible things such as chattels and land, arises out of this idea of possession. A lot of it, so such as adverse possession, of course, you are studying that in your land law. Possession underlies delivery in chattels, you know, sale of goods. A lot of doctrine in sale of goods is centered around the idea of possession. How exclusive rights arise, you know, you exclude the rest of the world from interference with the tangible thing. So much is about possession as being the central idea of tangible property law, the doctrine. So if you take that into the context of intangibles, such as intellectual property, if you don't have anything physical for you to hold as possession, would you develop your property principles around copyright completely differently, completely uninformed by the way the tangible property theory works? Or would you take inspiration from it? For me, because intellectual property and copyright are so different from debt and shares, and they're much more like chattels and land, there needs to be more of doctrinal exchange between what we know as property law of tangibles and land law, much more of principles and doctrines being transferred over and inspiring the further development of copyright and intellectual property law in general. So that is my argument. If you don't make this binary classification, the whole body of property law can develop much more organically, and you can have much more inspiration being drawn from land law and personal property law into copyright law, and in better understanding copyright law as well. That's the basis on which I'm saying property law, on the whole, will be in a better place if we not let this binary division happen. When we think of copyright as a property right, there is a school of thought that believes that if we insist on copyright being a property right, it will only lead to expansion. There is that sort of a very simplistic way of thinking that the moment you recognize copyright to be a property right, because property right means that you exclude the rest of the world, you only focus on excluding the world, which essentially means copyright becomes stronger and stronger and stronger. That is the idea some people have, a particular school of thought has. But I want to answer that by saying, just because you regard something as a property right doesn't automatically mean expansion, doesn't automatically mean that the person who holds the property becomes more and more powerful. It doesn't automatically mean that at all. If anything, it means the opposite. Because property law and property theory makes you take seriously the boundaries, whether it be the boundary of the thing or the boundary of the way you understand the exclusionary rights, what kind of duties you place on the rest of the world, or it's with the way you enforce it, the manner in which you enforce it, the kind of remedies you make available for that enforcement, or the way you design and carve out the derivative rights. In every one of these different ideas, property law makes you take boundaries very seriously. The boundaries are not only for the benefit of the person who has the property for their protection, not just for the owner himself, but also for the rest of the world. If you say that this is your property, you can't claim more than what is your property. That perspective is something this particular school of thought needs to appreciate as well. Property doesn't only mean the rest of the world is excluded. Property also means that the owner is prevented from claiming more than what he can claim. So that is where the limiting function of property lies. And in bringing the limiting role of property into the understanding of copyright, I argue in my book that you can contain the expansion of copyright rather than encourage the expansion of copyright. So it's entirely the reverse of what the popular understanding of copyright as property right is.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because I think property law feels quite intuitive. Speaking about tangible things makes sense to us. Mm. Whereas I think more of our life nowadays is dominated by the intangible. So you speak a little bit about how copyright in some ways is the most intuitive property right because we're constantly creating, you know, emails, photos, notes, your mum's drawing, obviously. Yes. Do you want to speak a little bit more about how the concept of thingness applies to this and how the everyday accessibility of copyright relates to this concept?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. Now, the reason why I talk about thingness is because underlying the idea of possession is the thingness. You see, now I'm holding this book.
Yeah.
So this book is in my possession and I'm able to hold it because obviously it has a physical existence, right? This thing is separate from my body and therefore I can hold it. It has its existence. And even if I put it down, it has existence of its own. So it has its own form. It has its own boundaries. So when it is damaged, I can see that it's damaged and I can kind of find somebody who is responsible for that damage if someone has, you know, negligently or intentionally interfered with its boundaries. So all of those things are very connected with the idea of thingness as far as the tangible thing is concerned. But now let's think of what is inside this book. Everything that this book contains by way of content, a lot of it is copyrightable. So it's all contained in here. Now, how do we take the idea of thingness from the tangible thing itself and try and apply it at a conceptual level to intangibles, something like a copyright work? Now, I have addressed this in my chapter 2 in my book. So I identified three things that are very important. Again, the idea of triangle, right? You don't always have two things.
It's always a third thing. Go on then.
which really makes the whole thing very interesting. Everybody understands that property law developed because we have valuable resources. You know, there's some valuable resources are so limited that we need to find a way of properly allocating it to people and using it fairly and efficiently. So resources are what is at the heart of property law. So these resources can be land, these resources can be other chattels, things that are manufactured, things that are naturally available. All of these are resources. When they're tangible, we don't really think that much more about how do we understand the normativity of the resource, which resource should or should not be extended the property protection. In general, so why should this table be protected? Do we think about that? Not necessarily. I mean, the table exists. It's been manufactured by somebody. It's valuable. Someone's put it out in the market. You've bought it. So it's got value. You see, we don't really look at the question behind the underlying normative question. What makes this table worthy of property protection? So tangibles, unless you push towards the boundary of tangible property theory, you don't ask that question of what resources should be protected. So we come to the question of human body parts. So if a human body part is severed, or human body itself, even before it's severed, human body itself, can it be the subject matter of property? Because we are tangible. We are also as tangible as this table is.
Yeah.
Could we, living human beings, become property? And obviously, upon the abolition of slavery, we do not regard human beings as capable of being the subject matter of property. So there is some normativity, even in tangibles. There is a limit to which resources can be protected, even tangible resources can be protected as property. So being a valuable resource and having that normativity of normatively justifiable subject matter is as much a question of tangible things as it is with intangible things. So before we regard something as an intangible thing, something that is capable of being an intangible thing, we need to think of whether normatively this subject matter can be protected. That is one thing. So normative content, the substantive content, the resource that we would like to protect.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first question. Second question, it needs to be separate from us. If it is part of us, like I said, you know, human body is not subject matter property. It's for ethical, moral reasons. It has to be separated from us. So if I separate my hair from my head, and then it's made into a wig, and then you know, it can be sold as a tangible thing. It's as acceptable to sell my hair as is this table to be sold in the market. So that we don't even bat an eyelid. But what about my eyesight? Can I separate my eyesight? What about my talents, my talent for singing? Can I separate that? There are some things that I simply cannot separate from myself. So those things, even though they're valuable, and even though to some degree we can call them resources, we cannot regard them as subject matter or property. They can't be separated from us. Ideas can be separated from us in a way that we can express it on a piece of paper or on a canvas. And that's how we bring it out of our mind and give it out into the world, present it to the whole world. And that's the idea of separation from us. And that's what copyright protects. Copyright never protects ideas. It only protects expressions. Until you have expressed it, copyright has no role to play.
Yeah.
If you have those thoughts at the back of your mind, copyright, or any law for that matter, has no way of reaching it. Only if you speak it, sing it, say it, write it, paint it, only then, when it comes out of you, that is the only time when copyright can protect it. And then the third thing is, the third requirement to complete the triangle, you need the form. You need to have, if it keeps changing its form, or if you can't at any given point in time tell where the boundary is, many of the ways in which you understand the rights, the exclusionary rights, and the enforcement and the remedies associated with those rights, you cannot have a clear enough idea of these things. So having form is important for so many different reasons, including how you define the exclusionary rights, how you enforce them, and how the remedies around it are built. So it's important to have a form. So how do we have a form in relation to copyright? If you look at the UK law, it says very clearly that those things such as songs or literary works, these can only be protected as copyright works if they have acquired a form, as in if they have been recorded either in writing or in some other form. So a song or this interview for that matter, mm-hmm. you know, if we were having this interview and you had no recording device, me saying those words are out in the air.
Yeah.
No one recorded it. So there's
a good
no
thing
copyright.
I've
there you go. So there is copyright in the words that I'm speaking right now because mm-hmm. you're recording it.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that you are recording it, not me, doesn't yeah. really matter. The mm-hmm. fact is it's recorded. Mm-hmm. And therefore, my spoken word has now acquired a form in that recording device.
This is why I record all my conversations.
There you go. Well, good, very good practice. So that is how copyright work arises in the first place. Until you've recorded it in some medium or not, until you've recorded it, copyright simply doesn't subsist in the work. So you see, these are three requirements. All three of them are satisfied. It is exactly the same three requirements you want in tangible things as well. If you at conceptual level can also replicate in the same way for copyright works as well, then you have a thing in copyright work as well. So that's how I feel it's possible. If we can create an intangible thing, if we can understand an intangible thing in relation to copyright by way of understanding copyright works, then a lot of the things that follow with the tangible thing, such as the idea of possession, idea of exclusory rights, idea of enforcement, idea of all the remedies, the same layering of doctrines that you see in tangible things can be similarly seen in relation to copyright works as well. So that is the intuitive effect I wanted to have with using copyright. Because unlike other intellectual property rights, such as patents or trademarks, which require registration for the right to come into existence, copyright doesn't. Copyright comes into existence automatically the moment you have recorded it. You see, the moment you give it a form, it's already, the property right already exists in it. So it's so intuitive for you to understand. The moment my mother finished painting this painting, she had copyright in it. The moment I finished writing this book, I had copyright in this book. So it was this kind of, the moment you finished writing your email, you mentioned emails, yeah, your notes, all of these things, because you record them, they're not just ideas floating at the back of your mind. You record them, you give it a form, you see them in black and white. They exist outside of you and they exist on their own without you having to do anything else once you have expressed it. So these are all the reasons why I felt it's possible for us to think of copyright work as a thing, and the same consequences that would have followed the thingness of a tangible thing will follow in relation to copyright works as well.
Yeah, solid. It's really interesting. So you mentioned a little bit about the law that governs what is considered a property right. And the prevailing view in English law, at least, is that that's determined by the numerous clauses principle. So why do you argue that this principle should be applied to copyright, and perhaps even with greater significance than to with tangible property rights?
Yeah, numerous clauses is one of those favorite topics of mine. I'm so glad you asked that question. It's also one of those things that I address in a lot of detail in my book. So in a preliminary sort of broad brush idea on page 10 of my book, I have given the basic idea of numerous clauses and how it applies specifically to copyright. But the one that I want the readers to, those who can get hold of my book, what I want them to focus on is figure 1.317 that I have. It gives the full image of what I think numerous clauses is doing in relation to intellectual property rights as a whole. And I've got a little bit more of a focus on copyright in particular. Now, what does numerous clauses do? Let's begin with that. Why is numerous clauses important? Now, you've done your first supervision of land law. You might remember numerous clauses may have been fleetingly mentioned there at section one, clause one of Law Property Act 1925, lists the legal property interests and the estates. Estates and interests are limited. Whatever have been mentioned there in that particular section are all you can have at law. In equity, you have slightly longer list, but that longer list is also limited. You can't just go on adding more and more property interests to the equitable side of the discussion as well. So you have the same principle applying. The number is limited. The number is closed. Now, why is that the case? Because if you look at the effect of a property right is a property right because it binds non-parties as well, non-parties to the transaction. So you and I entering into a transaction and you give me, let's say you sell me your scarf and I have now purchased it. This scarf, the rights I have in relation to the scarf binds not only the two of us, but it binds the rest of the world as well. In the sense that the duty to not interfere with my scarf, now it's become mine because I bought it from you, the duty to not interfere with this scarf applies to the whole world, not just you and me. Between the two of you, we may have had contractual right. You know, I may have to pay you for the scarf. All of those are contractual rights and duties. But the duty to not damage the scarf, the duty to not steal the scarf and take it away, all of these duties are held by the whole world. So that is the effect of a property right. Now, those rights that the rest of the world has, there is so long as I own the scarf, the rest of the world knows that owner has all of these duties. But if I had some other very strange interest in the scarf, let's say we entered into a relationship whereby a contract whereby you granted me in relation to the scarf, put out, you will have this scarf on Tuesdays. The rest of the week, I'm going to have it. On Tuesdays from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m., you can wear the scarf, and for the rest of the time, I'm going to have the scarf. If you gave me that sort of a right over the scarf, and if that became a property right, how does the rest of the world know what kind of property right this is? This is a contractual relationship the two of us have entered into. What does it even mean to the rest of the world, right? If we force this to become a property right, then it will mean that automatically the rest of the world has a duty not to interfere with the scarf on Tuesdays against Purna and on the rest of the days against Janice. Just doesn't make any sense. It's so fanciful, this whole thing. So that's what numerous clauses stops. Two people getting together and creating new property rights, which will be binding on the rest of the world. And the rest of the world will be just awestruck and completely in wonderment as to what kind of duties they have. So the two of us can't sit together here in my office and control the behavior of the rest of the world, right? Mm-hmm. So that is basically at the heart of this idea of numerous clauses. Now, why does it affect copyright? If you think about things of the mind, right? Copyright, that's what it's meant to protect. Of course, patents also, but in copyright, the expressions of the mind are meant to be protected. If these expressions of the mind include things like, oh, I came up with a fragrance, now I want to protect that as copyright. Is that going to be possible? Oh, I came up with this really nice taste of cheese. Mm-hmm. I'm going to copyright this. Mm-hmm. So what is the duty the rest of the world will have against this particular taste of cheese or this new fragrance I've created? Because it is scientifically shown, apparently, that fragrances are experienced by different people differently. Maybe the baseline understanding of what is floral, what is spicy, that may be different. That may be similar. But the real experience of how do you regard two fragrances as similar or identical is very differently perceived by different people. So it's a very subjective experience of the fragrance. It's the same thing with the taste. Depends very much on what kind of diet you have had, what kind of palate you have trained. And so it's very subjective, the way you perceive the taste of cheese. So these two are really actually real world examples where different jurisdictions have granted copyright protection to fragrances and taste. I don't think so, but fragrances, yes, mm-hmm. they have granted copyright protection. So now if you don't even know what the thing is, where the boundary of the thing is, if the boundary of the thing is perceived differently by different people because it's so subjectively perceived, then you don't even have a thing at the end of the day, which can be effectively enforced against the whole world. That to me is a violation of numerous clauses principle. There is a limit to the number of things, number of subject matter that can be protected under the law by copyright. And that stops at what you can perceive visually and orally. If you can perceive it by smell or by taste or by touch, each of these end up becoming very subjective. So the only objective things that can be things in copyright sense are those that you can see and hear. So you think about it. Now, music, you can hear, even if you don't read or even if you don't see it. Listening, music can be protected because when I play a note that has C, C sharp, E, G, A, you hear it with the same wavelength of each note. Mm-hmm. So it's objectively, you can objectively fix it or you can record it in a way that will be perceived the same way by everybody. It's the same thing with a language, right? If I use English language to write my book, when people read my book, they're taking in the same sentence, same set of words. So it's all objectively put down there. So visually, we perceive the same thing. Orally, we perceive the same thing with musical works as mm-hmm. well. So films and broadcasts, all of these are visual and oral kind of works. So my understanding of how copyright should be subject to numerous clauses is in not expanding copyright subject matter beyond what can be visually and orally perceived. You shouldn't expand copyright protection to those that give you smell, taste, or touch. Any of these other sensory perceptions, because they're so subjective, numerous clauses stops you from experiencing and granting copyright protection because basically you can't have thingness associated with it. So that's how that's one example of how numerous clauses works with copyright. The other examples can include what kind of transactions, what kind of derivative interests I create in relation to copyright. If like we talked about your scarf. Mm-hmm. Now, if it is a copyright work, let's say my book, right? This have the ownership of copyright 100% with me. Now, of course, I've licensed to Oxford University Press the ability to print the hard copies of hardbound copy of this book. Now, if they also have the ebook copyright from me. Now, if I wanted to make a serialized version of the book, take each chapter or each theme and publish it in some other journal, that's a different kind of derivative interest, different kind of license I should be able to scoop out and grant it to somebody else. Now, what is the limit to which you can extend these sort of derivative interests? There is, again, a limit to that. With land law, you will soon come to understand how easements and leases are, they are written stone what its ingredients are. Mm-hmm. You can't go beyond. If you want to extend into something that is beyond the existing types of easements, mm-hmm. then you can only develop it incrementally. So that's a principle you will set. And that's, again, numerous clauses principle. It's the same thing for copyright. If you want to develop your derivative interests in relation to copyright, you can only develop incrementally. You can't slice and dice copyright in such a way that you can just develop all sorts of fanciful transactions and expect the rest of the world to oblige and be bound by what you have created as an interest. So that's what applies to copyright as well, as much as it applies to land. That's another way in which numerous clauses applies to copyright. There is a third way that I also have argued in my book. It's in relation to exclusive rights. Mm-hmm. If you don't define exclusive rights in a reasonably careful manner, reasonably clear manner, if the right is too broadly worded, and if the courts come up with interpretation that is so far beyond the express words that are used in the statute, then that could also lead to violation of numerous clauses. You are not limiting the kind of exclusionary duties that the rest of the world has, because rights have duties on the rest of the world, right? So if you don't define the right astutely, the rest of the world will end up having too broad a duty. So that is something that the court should be very careful about. And that's the third, again, triangle, third important thing. That's another thing I've spoken about in different parts of the book. Yeah, chapter 1 and figure 1.3 will describe more. I think it will help, the figure will help understand numerous clauses in copyright.
Mm-hmm. This might be a silly question, but I mean, so obviously, numerous clauses in property law and land law is governed by the LPA. Is there a kind of similar statutory provision for numerous clauses with regards to property rights?
Very good question. That's not a silly question at all, Janice. In fact, I've written an article about this. Section 1, I think it happens to be Section 1, subclause 1 of Copyright Act as well, the CDPA, Copyright Designs and Patents Act. So that's the governing statute for copyright. It enumerates how many? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 7 subject matter as possible subject matter for copyright. So you have literary, dramatic, musical, artistic works. Those are authorial works, sound recordings, broadcasts, and typographical arrangements. Mm-hmm. Those are named. Beyond these, you can't have. So is this a closed list? There is a big question. Is this a closed list? So it is, again, a question of numerous clauses. I've actually not specifically talked about numerous clauses in my article, but that's the idea, basically. Mm-hmm. Is it a closed list and why is it a closed list? And I have referenced some sort of theoretical backing to it as well, but it's essentially a doctrinal question. Mm-hmm. Because statutorily it is bound to have this only 7 subject matter. So if you wanted, it was again in the context of the taste of cheese when the decision came about. That was when the debate was revived and we were asking that question. The decision came about in the CJU. We had a kind of introspection. If it had happened in the UK, what would we have done? Can we really have granted this taste of cheese copyright protection? Because it's not one of these 7 things. It's not a literary work. It's not, of course, a musical work. It can't be artistic work, is it? Dramatic work. It's not at all.
To me, it's dramatic. I care a lot about my cheese.
It can generate drama.
Oh, boy, does it.
So that was a question. It stirred that debate. And my conclusion in that article is that there is a reason why we have a closed list, and mm-hmm. we should keep to that. Mm-hmm. There is a way to develop incrementally and by analogy some of these things which are open-ended, like artistic work. What is an artistic work? Art is a developing field. You don't want to kind of box it up into being only sculptures or only paintings or only graphic design. You need to have some flexibility. You need to have freedom of art. So you can develop it, but you can't develop it in a way that would become totally unwieldy as far as the thingness of the whole idea of copyright work is concerned. If you can't record it at all, then how are you going to say that it can even be protected as a copyright work? So that was my argument. There is a limit to which you can expand. But as far as the core categories are concerned, core groups of works are concerned, that is a fixed list.
I imagine that's changed kind of how IP is thought about in the law. And with regards to copyright, if we have those like set seven provisions, which say this is a closed list, only these rights are protected, how is that going to change with AI? And do you think it should change?
I don't think so. AI, for all of its revolution, what it is a derivative use of existing copyright works. Mm-hmm. AI has not, so far at least, come up with anything that is outside of these seven categories of copyright works. We have questions about allocating copyright to robots or, you know, AI-generated works, whether AI-generated works can be protected, who gets the copyright, does the AI model itself get the copyright protection, or does the person who gives the prompt, give me a flying car? If you just say, give me a flying car, would you get the flying car copyright in the image itself? You know, those are the questions that we are trying to grapple with the revolution of AI. But it's not changing the fundamentals of what is protectable under copyright legislation. So far, those questions haven't come about. If AI ends up generating something that cannot be put into these different categories, then maybe, I mean, you know, it's difficult to think of what might happen in the future. It's too dystopian for me to think of generating something outside of these seven categories of works. But if that does happen, I suppose then the question will be, can we incrementally develop the idea of protectable works? But before that, I think there will have to be more fundamental question of, do we want to protect this? Why do we want to protect? Who is benefiting from it? Is the society going to benefit? Are we going to achieve the same copyright objectives? There's just so many other questions that you need to respond before you want to expand beyond the current statutory framework.
So you described the CJEU's interpretation of the right of communication to the public as wholly contrived and unjustifiable. How do you think adhering to the principle of numerous clauses helps protect UK domestic courts, especially post-Brexit? And how does it roll back some of the artificiality in this interpretation?
Yeah, it's quite a naughty question. Naughty, I mean K-N-O-T-T-Y. the reason is that those of us who've looked at copyright development of European copyright law over the last, 10, 15 years, since the Court of Justice of the European Union has given interpretation of this harmonized European law of copyright, we have closely followed particularly the interpretation of the right of communication to the public. And it's become so totally divorced from the words used in the directive or in any of the national legislation that we kind of begin to wonder, I mean, is the Court of Justice a judicial body or is it a legislative body? How is it possible that it's kind of imposing an interpretation of a directive in a way that simply cannot be justified based on the words used in the directive? The provisions of the directive only uses the word right of communication to the public. There is no mention of who this public is. Of course, that can be given for interpretation. So to some extent, it's possible for us to say the CJEU had the flexibility to interpret the word public to mean new public. So when you communicate to new public, that's when you infringe the right. You don't infringe the right when you communicate to the same public who already know. I mean, it's kind of truism, right? You don't communicate to the same people. If those people were already communicated to, they already had access to this work, you communicating over and above that doesn't really, again, exercise the work. When you communicate it to the new public, that's when. That's okay. I think to some degree it is defensible, although the word new doesn't exist in the statute itself or in the directive. But what they have come up with in more recent times, such as in GS Media, I think those listeners who will have done copyright law in their third year of TRIPOS degree If next year you take it up and come back to this podcast, you will know what I mean. The kind of interpretation that's been given in GS Media is something that a lot of us are extremely unhappy with. So essentially what happened there was that there were certain pictures of this model which were meant to have been published by Playboy magazine, and they hadn't yet come up with this publication yet, and these images were stored somewhere in a safe place. Those images were taken by another tabloid magazine and published even before Playboy had the chance to publish it, and they were communicated to the public. They were made publicly available on the internet by this other publication ahead of time. So the question was, is this communication to the public? So as far as being communicated to the new public is concerned, yes, it was to the new public, because initially Playboy wanted to communicate. It hadn't yet communicated. They were storing it in some space. They hadn't yet chosen the public to whom they wanted to communicate. So someone else coming and taking those images and communicating it to the public is, it can amount to communication to the public. But what about people who use the hyperlink and further communicate to everybody else? If hyperlinking to a particular source of information, which may be copyright work, if you hyperlink it to and make that hyperlink available to a whole host of other people, what about your obligation? Would you then violate communication to the public as well? To what extent you ought to know, first of all, that the image or any works that you are communicating are themselves infringements, or whether they are available on the internet free of any copyright restriction. Mm-hmm. So if you don't know, or if you had no reason to believe that this content was already violating copyright, then you don't communicate to the public. That's what the CJU said. This whole sort of interpretation couldn't be read into the right of communication to the public. They introduced the idea of knowledge. If I know what kind of content it is, then I communicate, because the statute doesn't say you have to knowingly do this or knowingly do that. It doesn't talk about any state of mind at all. This is just one example how it's read something into the statute which just didn't exist before. So all of this to me gives rise to the question of who are the people who are then in the receiving end as duty bearers? If you define the right of communication to the public in a particular way, you may want to benefit the copyright holder in defining the communication to the public in a broad and quite a wide manner. But if you do that, then you're increasing the number of duty holders by broad interpretation of the right.
Yeah.
So if those duty holders don't know how broad it can be, if you make it too vague and too general, then the duty holders will be left with a surprise when they are then held up for infringing the right. So that is a numerous clauses question.
Yeah.
You're basically imposing duties on the rest of the world by your own doing, that is judicial doing, which is not necessarily backed up by the express words of the statute.
Yeah.
So how justifiable is it?
Yeah.
That was the question with the right of communication to the public. I mean, CJU's decision in GS Media, in a way, you can think of it as much more restrictive interpretation. So it doesn't necessarily engage numerous clauses quite in the same way. But the whole jurisprudence surrounding communication to the public, how broad the right has become, that worries me. That a right like that, the judges also have a responsibility of keeping the interpretation of those rights within a limit that is within reasonable expectation of the people, and don't go just haywire out of their way to expansively interpret. But anything and anything can become communication in that sort of a world. So I think that's quite dangerous. It has the ability of overprotecting the copyright holder's interests. So I think, that's how I would connect it back to numerous clauses.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. So all this talk about duty, it's very reminiscent of tort and duty of care. You critique copyright infringements as kind of being a singular immutable tort with the strictest fault element. How do analogies with land law torts, where the fault element changes depending on the interference for trespass, private nuisance, negligence, suggest that the method of enforcement in copyright needs to be made more nuanced? What do you think about that?
I've addressed this question in Chapter 5. So essentially, copyright infringement is a tort that arises out of the statutory provisions. So there is a particular provision in Copyright Designs and Patents Act where it says it is an infringement of the copyright if you exercise any of the restrictive acts, as in any of those rights, without the consent of the copyright holder. Now, when you follow the analysis in that chapter, one of the things that comes across is that in the successive interpretation of what is an infringement, what is an infringing copy, and what is a copy, when is a copy made, when you look at all of these things, you will realize that copyright infringement has become this terribly strict tort with no differentiation available whether the infringement was done with a little bit with the awareness of what care needed to be taken to avoid infringement or not, whether any reasonableness can be read into this infringement within this whole discussion of infringement. All of these things just don't play a role at all in copyright infringement. You copied, and so long as we can see that you've copied, we will hold you liable. And even the idea of when we think a copy has been made, you know, it could be copy made consciously, which is okay, fine. If you consciously copy something, you should be liable for copyright infringement. But the worrying part is even subconscious copying can be regarded as copyright infringement. In fact, there are cases that tell you that subconscious copying is also copying. You know, you listen to a tune, it's there at the back of your mind. Somehow in your own process of creation, that tune has its voice. It comes up at the top of your head. And then as you compose something, you are using without even realizing that you've used that particular tune. So if you did that, apparently copyright infringement can catch you out. I kind of started thinking about, wait a minute, is this something we will do in relation to land? If we unconsciously walked into someone's land, you know, remember dreamwalking example and all of that, you must have read it in our tort textbooks, right? If it was automatism or whatever it's called, or if someone forcefully took you into someone else's land and all of those things that would be regarded involuntary, you will not be liable for trespass. Mm. You have to have a level of voluntariness in walking over someone else's land. You may not have knowledge that it is someone else's land, but so long as your walking is voluntary over someone else's land, you could be held liable for trespass. That is what we had read in relation to land. So even land make a distinction. Land torts make a distinction between conscious doing of an act and unconscious doing of an act. In copyright, conscious doing of an act and subconscious or unconscious even there are cases that tell you that totally unconscious copying is also copying. If you're doing something, if you're copying even without realizing you're copying, even that will amount to copyright infringement. So that was something that really threw me off. Mm-hmm. And I thought, why should copyright infringement be even stricter than even land torts? You know, land, this is our resource. We regard land torts, we take land torts very seriously, don't we? Trespass is a very serious tort. There is even criminal trespass. There are all these punishments available for trespass. So trespass we take very seriously, and we hold trespass at the heart of even keeping social peace. It is that important. And yet, in land, we make a distinction between conscious and unconscious act, and we don't make that distinction with copyright. That is, I think, ludicrous. If you overlay copyright works with digital world, not all copyright works exist in digital world, but to the extent that they do, they're accessible to the whole world. The rest of the world, which needs to keep off your copyright work, is so much larger in relation to a copyright work with its possibility of being digitally available than land. Land has its contextual location, whereas copyright works that are digitally accessible are exposed to the whole world. So if you don't define your infringement laws with the kind of astuteness that's required, even at least the kind of astuteness that you apply to land, then you are going to be holding too many people infringing, liable for infringement or copyright. Yeah. It exposes just too many people for this civil liability. Mm-hmm. And I think that's completely uncalled for. It's unreasonable. With copyright, the other very important part that we like, we want to balance is, of course, protecting the right of copyright holders is important, but the right of the rest of the public in being able to share in the knowledge, in developing their own knowledge and their own expression, deriving inspiration from each other and growing a body of work, that is also very important. What we call public domain, from where you derive your inspirations to write or to compose or to draw or to paint. We mm-hmm. all depend on each other's ideas. We all stand on each other's shoulders. Mm-hmm. So drawing and sharing on each other's ideas is very much part of how our societies have been built.
I mean, especially with art as well, I think that's such a fundamental idea in art.
Exactly. So when that is the case, what justifies having a copyright infringement tort, which is even stricter than land tort?
Yeah.
It just doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. So
is there a difference between like how that's actually enforced? Because I've heard it said, I don't know if this is true, but like when you're saying happy birthday, that's a copyright infringement. That's what I've heard. Is that true? And often, because that's obviously not enforced.
Yeah.
So maybe the difference, do you think is there a point to be made there?
That's true. I mean, a lot more infringement of copyright takes place than the number of them that are enforced. Mm-hmm. In fact, even very serious infringements of copyright, very obvious infringements of copyright are not enforced. But that doesn't mean that the tort has any excuse for being not astute. I think one of the reasons why such easy copyright infringement is one of the easiest torts to commit is because the enforcement is limited. Mm-hmm. And maybe also the way that the tort itself is designed is just ludicrously strict. And too many people, it catches too many people. It's mm-hmm. over-inclusive. And the other point I wanted to say was about private nuisance. And so trespass and nuisance, the difference between the two torts is that trespass is direct walking over someone's land and nuisance is indirect, right? So you emanate some smoke onto someone else's land and because that person can't enjoy their right. You haven't walked over that mm-hmm. person's land, but you have emanated smoke that has gone over mm-hmm. their land. So it's indirect infringement. So land makes a difference between direct and indirect infringement. Mm-hmm. So for indirect infringement in private nuisance, you remember there is a balancing exercise, right? So there's substantiality involved. There is, you know, after Fern, we have a very different way of understanding how the liability arises. So there is a give, there is a take. Live and let live, there is a lot of that with land. Is there such a thing in copyright? No. There's one immutable, like I said, one immutable copyright infringement tort, mm-hmm. which doesn't recognize voluntary or involuntary, direct or indirect infringement. So there is no reasonableness. There's no balancing act. There's not even a recognition that there's public domain that everybody mm-hmm. else needs to be able to dip into. Mm-hmm. Completely. And this is why infringement is too easy, and this is why infringement is not taken seriously. How many are you going to go after enforcing your copyright? At some point, even MGMs of the world, Sony Musics of the world, will have to stop at some point and say, gosh, I can't keep up with you infringers. I'll have to stop. I'll have to only catch those who are going to be able to give me enough amount of damages. Yeah. You see, it sort of belittles the whole idea. It makes a laugh. It makes it laughable that you have a copyright infringement as a tort. So yeah, I agree with you. There could have been lots more copyright infringement, but because of lack of enforcement and because of its undue strictness of the tort, a lot more infringement takes place than there is enforcement of it.
Do you want to talk a little bit about the relationship between public law and copyright? So copyright is recognized as a possession under A1P1 of the ECHR. How does the book explore the kind of dialectic relationship between the assertion of copyright as a right to peaceful enjoyment of possessions and the defense of freedom of expression under Article 10 of the ECHR?
Yeah, I explore this in the defenses to copyright infringement. So that would be, I believe, Chapter 6 of my book. So there are lots of defenses to copyright infringement, which are recognized within the statute itself. And these are what we call statutory limitations and exceptions. So you have exceptions like news reporting and quotation and review and criticism. All of these are all called fair dealing exceptions. Now, we need copyright infringement. Why we need additional protection for free speech generally is is because when you look at these statutory limitations of fair dealing exceptions that I just spoke about, be it news reporting or quotation, they're all very strictly bound by the statutory wording of the exception. So you have a particular statutory interpretation of what is fair dealing. And then fair dealing, so long as it relates to one of these many aspects, such as you've got to be in a journalistic setting, or you've got to be in criticism or review kind of a setting, you've got to be in classroom setting. You see, there are clear-cut exceptions that are carved out within the statute itself. Now, there are situations where you won't necessarily fall into any of these categories. You could be in a situation where you have a very, very good justification why you have to violate copyright of somebody, but you simply cannot bring yourself within any one of these exceptions. And I'm not making this up. You know, this is not a hypothetical, just an idea, thought experiment or something like that. This has actually happened. There have been lots of cases where the courts have held, sorry, none of the exceptions that are statutorily available to you, none of the defenses that would have been statutorily available to you are available to you in this case. Sorry, we can't give you any of these defenses, which essentially means that you infringe copyright. The copyright owner will have asserted their copyright, i.e. their property right, and their property right will have had a precedence over your free speech and expression, that sort of a defense. Essentially, what we will see in this kind of a situation is copyright is recognized as a possession under the first protocol of the Article 1 of ECHR. And that will mean that recognizing exceptions would be difficult. If you go through the situations where someone can justifiably interfere with your A1, B1 right, they can be quite restricted. That stays really important. That discussion is quite important for us to set the context. First of all, copyright is a possession according to A1, B1. But free speech is also equally important. Free speech under Article 10, I mean, obviously that there have been cases that have said there is no hierarchy of these human rights. There is no one right which will always trump over another. You need to always look at this in the round. You'll have to have the step-by-step analysis. The justification is different depending on each case. So you don't necessarily say property is more important than free speech. So it's all well and good for us to keep hearing that it's not really a dialectic relationship. It really depends on the facts of the case. But it hasn't really practically worked out like that. There has almost been no case at all where a party, litigating party, has won a case based on free speech, whereas the person whose copyright it was, although it's been infringed, the infringement has been held to be justifiable under the free speech argument. Mm-hmm. If this free speech argument has gone above and beyond the recognized defenses within the statute itself. You see, so it's all well and good for us to say it's not a dialectic relationship. Let's look at each case in the round. But year after year, if you keep only insisting that A1, P1 right is the one that wins at the end of the day, copyright holder is the one who walks away with a successful copyright infringement case, and if the defenses never really take shape, then how are you going to believe that there really isn't a hierarchy of this sort? There isn't really this sort of dialectic relationship. That is where we are, right? If I could give a live example. So the case was Ashdown and Telegraph. So this was a case where Ashdown was the author of certain minutes of a particular meeting which he had had. It was a confidential meeting he had had, and he wanted to use the minutes of that meeting, which he had authored, in his book. Mm. He wanted to write this book after his political career had ended. Telegraph happened to have laid its hands a copy of those minutes, and they published it before he could publish his book. So he sued Telegraph for copyright infringement, saying, you know, they copied, they reproduced this, these minutes, it's copyright infringement, and he needs to be compensated for that. Of course, I think it was too late for them to request for an injunction preventing the publication of it, I believe. Anyway, the question was, would you side in favor of Ashdown in protecting his copyright? Or would you side with Telegraph in saying Telegraph has free speech, right to freedom of expression? So if they laid their hands on these minutes, and if these minutes were of public importance, and if they wanted to put it before the public, it should be possible for them to exercise their free speech right without being constrained by the copyright protection that this minutes attracts.
Mm-hmm.
So you see how the two rights are kind of pitted against each other. Telegraph is saying it's my free speech, and Ashdown is saying, no, it's my copyright. You can't reproduce it without my consent. And I would never have consented for these minutes to have been published in the newspapers before I could use it in my book.
Mm-hmm.
So the question, eventually Ashdown won. So copyright protection because of his A1P1 right, he won. And the reason why Telegraph lost out was that the court said, why did they have to reproduce the full verbatim minutes? They could have taken extracts from it. If they had taken extracts from it, which was relevant to their story, then it would have had equal power. And that would have ensured that their free speech was exercised reasonably. And that would have amounted to fair dealing exception, which is, you know, news reporting. And in that context, for news reporting, you only need excerpts from the minutes and you don't have to verbatim produce the full minutes in your newspaper. Well, I suppose there is a bit about it that is defensible. But the whole point is these minutes, With their exact way it was recorded, exact turn of phrases, exact time when it was recorded, how many people were there, who were there, all of these things in the way, if you just put those minutes in front of the public, obviously the effect is so much more powerful in comparison to saying, we have the sight of the minutes, but this is what the minute says. We are not going to show you because we can't show you. We can't show it to you because that is copyright infringement. You know, it just makes the whole press freedom so much more constrained if they can't put this whole document in front of the whole public. So that's the kind of dialectic relationship. Free speech is constrained because of copyright assertion by Ashdown, whereas the court still believes that free speech could have been exercised within the limits of the law by only showing excerpts but not verbatim reproducing the full set of minutes, which was not required for the exercise of their reasonable rights. So in this context, the court said, in an appropriate case, it is possible that free speech might win. We still haven't seen that appropriate case. It makes us wonder whether copyright protection is being pushed forward as a bit too strong of a right. Mm-hmm. Now, even having human rights arguments being used to protect it even further, even in the public law space, and whether that is a positive development. It's something for us to see going forward. And I hope when an appropriate case comes up, there is real application of mind as to the importance of free speech and the importance of public domain, importance of being able to share in the common knowledge amongst all the people who have this responsible job to do in the rest, in exposing these sort of stories to the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, journalistic freedom. Yeah, I wonder how that could be given greater precedence over copyright protection, and which case will actually say it in so many words, such that we now have it in our case law that says it is possible for free speech to win over copyright protection.
So one of the most interesting parts of your book is the graph that you include at the end, where you visually map out different resources, chattel, lands, copyright works, confidential information, and debt, against the core metric of property rights like thinghood, acquisition, exclusionary powers, enforcement, remedies, and derivative interests. The layers narrow as we move along the spectrum, showing how these characteristics attenuate with more intangible assets. I just thought that that graph was so interesting. And do you want to talk a little bit more about what you're aiming to achieve with this visualization?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I'm very happy the graph made it to the book as well. In fact, in my original manuscript, the graph wasn't there. It was my editor who pushed me to include the graph because I thought it should remain in the reader's mind and readers should be able to conceptualize in whatever way they want. But my editor said, no, it will be better for them to have some hand-holding from you, what you conceptualize it to be. And I think that was spot on. It was very a good suggestion in the end. So what I've tried to do here is, instead of regarding tangible and intangible as the only, as in the physical, our ability to physically feel, touch, and hold a thing as being the only basis for classifying resources between tangible and intangible, what if we think of characteristics that are way beyond the physicality of the resources? Because we are moving into a world where tangible resources are important, yes, but they are much less important in comparison to some of the intangible assets that are coming to fore as being the big players in the economy these days, right? You know, what is the value of goodwill of Microsoft? Why is it that the most valuable company, such as NVIDIA or something, will reach a share value of the kind that it has reached? Where is that value coming from? It can't be with the tangible assets they hold. I mean, any number of physical assets they hold will not add up to $1 trillion or whatever. Crossing the $1 trillion mark, it just cannot reach that just with the physical assets they have. It has to be that NVIDIA or Microsoft or Amazon, all of these have their valuation going through the roof because of so many of their intangible assets are all being valued at that particular valuation, which essentially kind of turns this whole thing on its head, the whole idea that we can have tangible and intangible as the binary classification of property. It just makes the whole thing look laughable. Tangibility is no longer the watershed characteristic to classify or even understand how valuable resources function and what their importance is in the whole world economy as a whole. So I think it would be important for us to understand from a property law and property theory perspective, what are the kind of metrics that we can apply to understand how we organize doctrines and principles in property law in general. If we can have some of those metrics which will cross over from tangible to intangible property, then we can measure the same. We can measure any resource applying the same metrics. Mm-hmm. So the metrics would be what I have identified on the last page. That could be thinghood. Thinghood, again, has three characteristics, which I just talked about in answer to an earlier question. Acquisition, basically the idea of possession comes into it. So possession is only the word possession itself. The terminology of possession is reserved for tangible things. But you can develop an idea, which is by analogy, you can develop in relation to intangibles. With some, you can do that, like copyright. I have demonstrated in my book and in also my other works that it's possible to show possession by analogy with the intangibles. So that's acquisition, second characteristic. Third one is exclusionary rights. So the rights function, the content of the rights is different when you have tangible things, because all you need to not do is either physically interfere with it, take it away or destroy it or something like that. With intangibles, the rights and the duties are different. The duties are you shouldn't copy or you shouldn't communicate, you shouldn't perform. You see, these are all actions that are very different from the kind of actions that you're expected to do in relation to tangibles. Mm-hmm. So understanding the exclusionary rights and their exclusionary duties and their content is another metric you can measure through these various resources. Mm-hmm. And the fourth one is enforcement. Like I said, you have trespass, nuisance inland, and you have conversion in and trespass to chattels with chattels, and you have copyright infringement, which is just one tort. But if you were to be able to find some kind of analogy, where would you put the enforcement of copyright to be? And in the same way, other resources, such as you can map the whole thing with other resources as well. And the fifth one is remedies. Some of the remedies are much more proprietary than the others. So the two proprietary remedies I've discussed in the book specifically are negotiating damages and account for profit. I'm not going to go too much into detail. There's too much technicality in there, but these are kind of remedies that are available when you have rights that impose duties on the rest of the world not to do something. So negotiating damages come into picture, and also a counter-profit where you have kind of disgorgement. The measure of damages is based on the amount of profit they have made rather than the amount of loss you have suffered. You know, that sort of a remedy is available only for rights that are much more proprietary than those that are less proprietary. Mm-hmm. So remedies can say a lot about whether a subject matter is capable of being a property or not. And then derivative interests, which is, you know, to what extent you can create, you can scoop out the wholeness of ownership into individual smaller interests that are sustainable, that are compliant with numerous clauses, and that are transactionally important, that create further value, like copyright licenses, copyright assignments, or patent licenses, or security interests. You know, can you put forward the script of your film as a security to raise loan for the making of your film? These are all possible. You know, these transactions continually do take place. To what extent these define the property-ness of the resource that underlies it? All of these ideas and understanding would give us a nice and a kind of coherent image of what would have happened had the subject matter been tangible. What would happen if the subject matter is intangible? Can the things that happen in tangible property context be useful in understanding the intangible context, especially in places like security interests and other sorts of transactional efficiency? Yeah. That would be a useful thing to understand. So when you have these metrics, I regard these six metrics as the ones that I have had the chance to explore here. There may be more. Others may regard these metrics as conflating. They may want to add more. They may want to take away things. Whatever. My research has led me to these six metrics. So if you put six metrics on one axis, and if you put all the resources on the other axis, and try and give a value to each one of those resources. So you start with chattels, you give chattels a particular value, because chattels, the thingness is very, very certain, isn't it? That's why we call them chattels. They're tangible, they can be held, there is a particular idea of possession, you know exactly what kind of exclusionary rights that arise in relation to these chattels. So you can build up assigning particular values in relation to each one of those metrics. And then you take the next resource in and amongst tangibles, which is land. Land, the idea of possession is different. You can't hold land in your hand. You have to understand possession in a different way with land. Your exclusionary rights are different in land. It's about walking over your land. You can't talk about walking over this pencil, can you? But it has exclusionary rights that are very different from land as a whole. So what are those exclusionary rights? How are they enforced? The torts are different. The ingredients of the torts are different. So all of that you would kind of map in relation to land. And then you move over to other sorts of resources. You could have copyright. You can plot the same things with copyright, assigning particular number to how robust these metrics are met in relation to copyright. You can have patents, you could have the same metrics, you could have trademarks, you could have the same metrics, confidential information, the same thing, data, shares, debt. When you have all of these resources, the important ones, when you put them all on x-axis and then you put the metrics on y-axis, it's possible for you to develop something that looks like a spectrum. You see, and other digital assets, I mean, to talk about the Law Commission's recent work on digital assets, such as, it doesn't have to be crypto necessarily, but any sorts of other digital assets, such as NFTs and things of that nature. Yeah. So all the digital assets could also be placed somewhere along this spectrum. My argument is, instead of saying tangible, intangible, finish the story, move on, have these metrics which are much more nuanced in the way they have their inroads that they create in relation to each one of these resources. So if you map them in the visual way that I have done in the book, they give you an idea of a spectrum of property rights rather than the binary classification of shows as an action and so shows as in possession. So it's a different way of looking at property rights. You might still come up with classification of tangible, intangible, and then within intangible, you may have many other classification. There are property theorists who have done this sort of a classification as well. It's not something I'm necessarily averse to, but what I'm saying is, why xylos in the first place? Why tangible, intangible makes such a big difference. It's not so much about the physicality. It's really more about how the law sees it. Put on those glasses of the law, you know, have that perspective of the law to see these resources in the way that I have drawn the metrics to be, rather than looking at them with our own eyes, such as, you know, what can I touch and feel?
It feels quite primitive now that you actually...
We've moved on, you know, from the time intellectual property has been introduced into the legal system, we have already made a revolutionary change in the way property needs to be understood. From that time onwards, the wheel has been moving on and on. The progress has gone so much. It's just that the progress has gone in a way that the specialists go in one direction and the core idea of property has gone in a different direction. I'm trying to bring it all together in a way that doesn't confine itself to the archaic tangible intangible understanding, but in a way that is much more nuanced and in a way that law sees it rather than our own pair of eyes see it.
What's brought us back to the beginning of the conversation feels like a good place to end off. We've gone in a circle. But thank you so much for doing this. That was really helpful.
Thank you for having me.
I really enjoyed that conversation. Brilliant.
Thank you. Thank you, Janice.
That was my discussion with Porna. And as said, I've attached a picture of the graph on the Instagram. So check that out if you're interested. I'd also like to say that I don't actually record all of my conversations, just in case anyone is wondering. I record some of my conversations, such as this one. But broadly speaking, you can talk to me and not need to worry about our conversation being copyrighted. I just thought I would make that clear, just in case anyone was wondering. That was a joke. A bad one, but I can take that on its head. The holidays are coming up, and hopefully you all enjoy yourselves with your families over Christmas. And yeah, that's all I've got to say. Bye, everybody!